Welcome back to the UFO Rabbit Hole Podcast. I'm your host, Kelly Chase. Today, I'm bringing you something a little different. As most of you already know, my new media company, Ontocalypse Productions, headed up by myself, J. Christopher King, and Jordan Flowers, is currently in the midst of completing our first docuseries due out this summer entitled The Beyond, UFOs and a New Reality. While we're hard at work on that, posting for the podcast will be a little bit more sporadic over the next few weeks. But rest assured that the UFO Rabbit Hole will be back to its regularly scheduled programming in June. And you'll still be getting a couple more new episodes in the meantime, including part two of the Through the Looking Glass series before then. But while things are a little quieter around here, I thought it would be a great opportunity to bring you guys something special. That's why I'm teaming up with Jay to bring you a series of never-before-released talks from his phenomenal Inquiry into Anomalous Experience and the Phenomenon conference series, or Inquire Anomalous for short. Regular listeners of the show have definitely heard me talk about Inquire Anomalous before. These have been my absolute favorite conferences to attend over the past few years. They're small, intimate, and the all-star lineup of speakers who are truly on the bleeding edge of anomalous studies makes it an absolutely unmatched experience. In this first talk, presented by Inquire Anomalous, we'll be hearing from Tim Gallaudet. Tim Gallaudet is a retired Rear Admiral in the U.S. Navy and a career oceanographer. His former roles include serving as the Deputy Administrator of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, as well as the Oceanographer of the Navy. He's also the former Superintendent of the U.S. Naval Observatory. More recently, Admiral Gallaudet has made exciting contributions to the field of UAP studies, particularly in the realm of the too often overlooked subject of USOs, or Unidentified Submersible Objects. He recently released a new article through the Soul Foundation, which is a must-read on the topic. I've linked that up in the episode brief. Before we dive into this exciting talk, I want to mention that this episode is also brought to you by The Experiencer Group. The Experiencer Group is a private online community dedicated to support, curiosity, and community for people who've had anomalous events of all kinds. They hold regular support meetings for people who are processing anomalous experiences, book clubs, special guest speaker presentations, and more. You can learn more and sign up at tegmembers.com. The link is in the episode description. And finally, if you'd prefer to watch the video of this talk, that will be going live this Friday, April 5th, on the Inquire Anomalous YouTube channel. I'll have that linked up as well. Now, here's Leslie Kane introducing Tim Gallaudet at the Inquire Anomalous Conference held in New York City in December of 2023.
So I'm very happy to introduce Tim Gallaudet. He's going to tell you a little more about himself, but he is a retired Rear Admiral within the Navy, an oceanographer. He served as the Assistant Secretary of Commerce for Oceans and Atmosphere, excuse me, within the U.S. Department of Commerce, and was the head of NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. And we've just been very fortunate that Tim has come forward and really been contributing a lot of important articles that he's written, and he's been speaking at conferences and on podcasts. He's a tremendous addition to the work that all of us are trying to do towards transparency, and I'm very pleased to welcome Tim Gallaudet.
Thank you so much for that, Leslie. It's a real honor to be on your team now, really. I'm kind of a newcomer to this whole world of the phenomena, and I'm just trying to contribute. Now, so I'll talk a little bit about that. So Leslie mentioned I was in the Navy for 32 years, retiring as a one-star admiral. And often in these venues, I talk about the fact that I had a senior level in the Navy and then a senior level in government. But what I don't normally talk about is I worked my way up. And so I was on many ships like this one, the USS Kitty Hawk, an aircraft carrier. And so much of the discussion on UAP involves the Nimitz incident and what Ryan Graves saw off Theodore Roosevelt, two aircraft carriers like one of these. And so when they speak, and Alex Dietrich, who's in the room, I believe, there she is. So when they speak about what they've observed, I have working knowledge of what they've gone through. And I want to use my voice and platform to really just promote their credibility. So I know what it's like is what I mean. And then also, if you go back, there you go. So then I worked at this other agency called the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, which is the nation's top climate, ocean, weather, science agency. And it was just a wonderful place. We had about 20,000 people, a couple thousand PhDs, 16 ships, 9 aircraft that fly through hurricanes, 18 weather environmental satellites, all doing, collecting data and supporting the American people, whether it be through charts for ships at sea and in ports, or weather forecasts and typhoon and hurricane warnings. So it was a really great experience for me. And I'm trying to use that background, if you will, as a government science leader, again, to promote the scientific research of UAP. And we can talk a little bit about that, or I will actually, and I'd love to hear your thoughts and questions afterwards. But that's sort of what I bring to the table here. A little unlike Joshua, I'm a little more of the former bureaucrat, but I know how the government works, and a lot of us are advocating for disclosure by the U.S. government, and you need to understand how to navigate that big bureaucracy to make that happen, and I'll explain a little bit about it. But yeah, so my UAP interests actually formed over a decade ago when I was the superintendent of the U.S. Naval Observatory. Now, this is a well-known place because the vice president lives there, and at the time, President Biden was the vice president, and I've met him a few times. But the job of the Navy command is to basically produce star catalogs, and the universe is expanding, so they have to be updated. The stars move, and they're used for satellite navigation. So everybody has a device, and they use GPS, and GPS tells you where you are. But how does GPS know where it is? The GPS constellation. Bob McGuire knows as well, and they fix the positions of the satellites but off of star positions. And that's a whole complicated thing called the celestial reference frame, but ultimately that's the job of this command. And so I work with astrophysicists and astronomers, and they're great people, but it gave me the appreciation of how big the universe is. Our galaxy, we don't even know the number of stars in it. It's between 100 and maybe even 400 billion stars. And then we're part of an observable universe that's billions of galaxies. And that's really an unknowable scale. We really can't in our lives know how big that is. We can cite the numbers, but in our experience, we'll never know what that scale really is. So I got to appreciate the fact that it's arrogant for us to think we're the only intelligent life form in the universe. And so that was just sort of simmering in the back of my head. So next one, please. And then basically I was given evidence, and some of you might have seen me a show or podcast or two where I talked about this, so forgive the repeat, but it's worth sharing with you. So when I was a one-star admiral, I reported to this four-star admiral, U.S. Fleet Forces Command in Norfolk. He was my boss, and I was one day on the Navy's secret network, and this was while Ryan Graves was flying off the East Coast off the Theodore Roosevelt doing training for a deployment. And during that time, my sailors were on his ship and they were forecasting weather. That's what my folks did. And they were on every aircraft carrier forecasting weather and other things. And so I get this email and it's addressed to me and all the 20 or so subordinate 1 and 2 star admirals under Fleet Forces Command. And these are some heavy guns. There are people like this other strike group commanders. So the Theodore Roosevelt strike group commander, 1 star, and then support commands like mine. Mine was a support command where we did weather and oceanographic support. And the email title was Urgent Safety of Flight. And this is on the Navy's secret network, and so it's not shared with a lot of people. It came from the operations officer of my boss, the 4-star admiral, and he asked all of us, if any of you know what this is, I want you to tell me ASAP, because we're having numerous near mid-air collisions, and we're going to have to shut down the exercise. And attached to that email was the GoFast video before it ever got leaked. This is 2014 or 15. I don't remember the exact date. And of course, I just put two and two together. And I knew then and there, we're not alone. We're being visited by don't know what, but obviously some kind of technology that is way more advanced than what we have. And it was easy for me to be convinced of that being some other world or non-human type of intelligence because, first off, our adversaries don't have this capability to move like these things moved, and there were many of them. And I know that because I had a top secret clearance, and I knew what our threat capabilities were. Secondly, is this isn't a training range. So some people have speculated, oh, maybe it was like the Defense Advanced Research Project Agency or one of these government labs doing some advanced project. And that just does not happen. You do not do that kind of work in training ranges because of the safety of flight issues. That's all in testing ranges, and there's many of them across the country. That just was there. But then, and even more surprisingly, the next day, that email was wiped from my computer. So it was gone, unexplainably, and everybody else who received it. And then when I went to weekly meetings with all those other people that it was addressed to, one and two-star admirals, all my friends, none of this was ever talked about. And I found that just incredible because my job of many was I was the chief meteorologist of the Navy. So my job was safety of flight. That was one of my most important missions. And you have these things almost colliding with aircraft, and we're not talking about it? So I had to just sit with that because knowing it was obviously when it was wiped from my computer, it was easy to conclude, okay, this kind of data goes into some special access program run by the intelligence community. I know because I've been read into many of those, and I just had to sit and like let that go, unfortunately. And I'll explain why I didn't like doing that. But that's what happened. So fast forward to today, this year, and everybody's aware, I believe, in this room of this hearing, this historic hearing that occurred with the House Oversight Committee and testifying to UAP and advocating for disclosure. And I'm actually, I got a front row seat. Thank you, Ryan Graves. I was in the very far left over there. And we've really come a long way from that one observation of mine around 2015, where it was still tightly under wraps, to then Leslie breaking the story in 2017, and now a hearing before Congress. So let's give Leslie a round of applause. Thank you. And I was so pleased about this. For one, I couldn't say anything while I was still in the government. But next one, Jay. So now I'm on the board for Ryan's American for Safe Aerospace. And I very eagerly asked to join his team because of what happened to him. And this is what probably motivates me almost more than anything, in that here he was, a young pilot out there having his fellow pilots almost colliding with these objects, and which is of concern. I mean, when you hear him on the testimony, he talks about a Section 2 aircraft that got split by one of these things within meters. When you're flying a high-performance jet aircraft, you don't want anything to be within a mile of you. So that's just scary, okay? And so that knowing that was occurring, and because of overclassification, leadership failed those pilots, and including him, in terms of mitigating that threat and looking out for their safety because of the overclassification and so on. And so he's coming out now to advocate for pilots reporting more, to remove the stigma, especially with the FAA, because right now it's a career killer to report these things, which is absolutely wrong. And same in the Navy. And so that's why I want to be his champion and Alex's and others, because I'm actually surprised why other admirals and generals are not speaking out about this. There's many reasons, but the safety one is I think, very important. So that's... Thank you. And so that's kind of one line of effort I'm going after. It's just great to be with him and his team. So I'm also working with Avi Loeb as a research affiliate. And everybody here follows Avi, I'm sure, in some way. And he's a great personality, really great human being, and just a terrific mind. He thinks, I think, very intelligently about our place in the universe. And I even wrote an article with him on that very topic. And so I don't do that much with him, but I did oversee an observatory, and what I can do, I try to contribute. But it's just good to be. I like what he's doing because he's going after the science, and I think that's just as important as the safety. Now, interestingly, one of his teammates is this woman, Beatriz Villarroel, and she's a Swedish astronomer. And I learned about this project of hers, which is just fascinating, especially because I was an observatory superintendent. And what she's doing is she's looking at historical photo plates, basically, not even digitized, old telescope data, and comparing it to newer data. The upper left there is a Palomar Observatory image from 1952, and the one on the right is 1991. And this is a very capable 200-inch telescope, and you're seeing in the circles basically missing stars. They use the term transients, but that's what's going on here. And I mean, who cannot be fascinated by that? That's a very authoritative instrument. And I mean, Hubble used it to determine that the universe was expanding. I mean, this is not something like, oh, there's, you know, something in the data, or this instrument might have had a flaw or electronic glitch. It's like, that's just not the case. And she goes through a number of different sort of angles, looking at potentially the effects of gravitational lensing on some kind of random object nearby, and pretty well refutes that could be the case, and she just leaves it out there. But she's a great scientist. I put this up here, too, because she earned this award from the Heterodox Academy recognition, because people like us who are trying to put out there in the scientific community what's happening as is Abhi, you're getting a lot of, we are all getting these naysayers, and the stigma remains, unfortunately. And she was a target of that, which is unfortunate. I'm glad she was recognized. Real bright person, love what she's doing. So that's the kind of work that's happening with the Galileo project, just attracting all these bright minds. And then also, people might be aware of Abhi's search for the remains, the fragments of a interstellar meteor, the first one that was observed. And here he is on the ship that he chartered to recover those fragments. And it's interesting, too, because he's gotten some naysayers to refute his findings. He did go collect some of these fragments. They're called spherules. And he did a very methodical constituent and component analysis of the debris. And I can tell you with 100% certainty that he played by the ultimate book. He did everything right, because the MO for his expedition was something NOAA did in 2018. We found the remains of a meteor that impacted the sea surface off Washington State, and we used a NASA astronomer and a magnetic sled. Everything they did, they followed a playbook that had already successfully been done. Now, this one was difficult because the one in Washington was only about, I forgot, it was maybe 100 meters depth, not that deep. This was 1.7 kilometers deep, so this was a tall order. When you're towing a sled with a 1.7 kilometers of tow line, it's not like precision survey. But he had some of the most accomplished ocean engineers on board with decades of experience, and I advised on the entire expedition, and including finding from my old agency, NOAA, the winds in the atmosphere from the surface all the way up to the currents in the ocean from the sea surface down to the bottom, and knowing how the currents changed with depth and as well as the atmospheric winds, we were able to determine very well the position of the debris field, and he found it, which is really a great accomplishment. So it's fun to be working with him in this domain, and he's all energized now. He's like working out at sea. He's totally foreign to him. He's only been in a lab his whole career, so I like that he's getting exposed to that. And so what my kind of focus is, since I have a background in oceanography, I've been at sea for decades and doing ocean science expeditions, I'm trying to use that knowledge, that network of mine, to look at the undersea side of UAP. This is a pretty famous image captured by the USS Omaha off Southern California. That's what the ship looks like. And we know this. We have multiple observations of these objects going transmedium. And I think since I know everybody in the government and academia doing ocean stuff, I want to start using that to see what we can learn. So interestingly, and I think this is really powerful. So this guy, Victor Vescovo, is a friend of mine, and he's kind of like the underwater Neil Armstrong. In 2019, I partnered with him. He built a submersible and bought a ship with his own money. He's a private equity investor. And he dived in the deepest trenches in the ocean, all five of them, including Challenger Deep and the Marianas Trench. And no one had ever done all those before. And so he's below 10,000 meters in each one of those, which is really deep. and he did some great science for us. We had people on a ship. That's why I signed an agreement with him. But it turns out he was going to put a new sonar on his ship in 2020 and go off SoCal. And I, because of all the UAP activity off SoCal, I was wondering, I thought, you know, hey, maybe we'll find evidence on the seafloor of any interaction of these phenomena objects with the seafloor. And, you know, people here have probably seen some of these shows on underwater alien bases off Catalina, like Ben Hansen's UFO Witness, I think, had an episode. And I just thought, well, shoot, he's going to have the most advanced sonar in the world out there. And I gave him, I asked him, hey, you know, if you really want to do an underwater expedition like nothing else, I have some coordinates for you and where UAP had been observed. And I wasn't sure how he'd respond, if he even would respond. And he wrote me back and he said, send me the coordinates. And so I gave him locations of known UAP activity that it was within reach of San Pedro where he took the ship. So there's Catalina, and this is the area that he went. And he hit a couple of places I asked him to go. And we didn't see anything really unusual except for this feature. And it's like what you see here is the bathymetry, and it's an underwater ridge called a knoll. And this element of it just displaced about 2 kilometers, and the height of that object of debris is about 700 meters. And I am friends with some of the most renowned marine geologists in the world, like Robert Ballard, others. And right now, I've showed this to them, and they really can't explain it. Because normally when you have these underwater avalanches, they're called turbidity flows, it's like an avalanche. The whole thing just sort of slumps down. And you don't get this total horizontal displacement of a hard like object of mass, and it's called a schist, is the name of the geological rock. And I can't explain it. You can just see it just move. So I just want to look at it. So I'm trying to get an ROV on it, a remotely operated vehicle with a video camera. And we're in the process of trying to get that expedition underway just to see what that is. And that's kind of where I want to go, is start looking at the seafloor, the ocean, in areas that we've seen activity and learn a little bit more about, see if we can learn a little bit more about what they are. So that's just one example. Next slide, please. So interestingly, part of the other effort I want to do is, so I happen to work with this body called the Ocean Studies Board under the National Academies of Science, Engineering, and Medicine. And this is the Hall of Fame of ocean science. These are some of the best oceanographers in the world, in the country, and they do studies on ocean issues like the impact of marine plastics on fish and human health and food security, etc. All these ocean issues that are out there, coral reef decline and things like that. And I'm on that body, and I put forward to them. I said, why don't we ask the government to put out all their data on the ocean, and we could, let's do a survey and see if we find any anomalous phenomena. And with that targeted in mind, because a lot of times anomalies are they're bad data and they throw them out. They're categorized as bad data and they throw them out. Well, why don't we just look at the data? So I put this forward to the Ocean Studies Board, and they said, we should be doing this. This is important. NASA's got a study team. We should do this too. But Tim, you know what? We don't look at classified data. The Naval Studies Board, our sister organization in the academies, they do. Why don't you go to them? I said, great, okay. So I went to them. The co-chair is this guy, retired 4-star Admiral Gary Roughhead, formerly the Chief of Naval Operations, top admiral in the Navy, and formerly my boss. I reported to him in the Pentagon, and so I knew him. I go to Gary, and I say, what do you think, you know, about looking at all the data and looking for anomalies? And he said, we should be doing this. How about that? And he thought it was good because not only should we be doing that for this, knowing what this phenomenon is, he thought we're also getting outclassed by China and we should have a better understanding of the ocean than them. So he liked that from a national security and just from a scientific understanding. And so my next step is to get the government bodies that do this stuff, that have ocean data, and there's 3 of them, to fund the study. Not an easy thing to get money out of the government, but I know people. I know the commanders of every one of them. Yeah. It's the Naval Oceanographic Office, my old agency, NOAA, and the Office of Naval Intelligence. And I know all 3 of their directors. So we'll see how this goes.
We'll be right back after this quick break.
So as I go, I've been going around and learning about the phenomena, engaging with 5 people like you and Leslie and Alex and Diana here and Peter. I've learned that there are a lot of experiencers out there, and they're not just people in rural America. They're government employees on ships and aircraft, and they're out operating, and they're seeing these things all the time. So in my 1 year or so of just talking to former shipmates and friends, some are still in. These are the places that real observations have been seen by credible people I know and trust. And these are the platforms they've all been on, which is just remarkable when you think about this. I'm doing an amateur survey right now And we're talking about ship watch officers and COs and aircraft commanders. It's kind of incredible. So if this is all known, you got to think the government has data out there a lot more than they're revealing. And we know this, of course, through the testimony at the hearing from Dave Grush and elsewhere. So I just thought I'd show that to y'all because that's really striking to me. It was Keith. Keith, you asked about undersea stuff. Now, there's what's interesting is submarine data, and there's a submarine here you see, is a lot of it goes to these two big labs that build sonars, John Hopkins and this research lab up in Penn State. And it's all very highly classified. But I also do know the commander of undersea surveillance, the person who runs the Navy's SOSUS networks. And I've asked around. Right now, no one's shared anything with me, but I'm just going to have to dig a little harder. But there's definitely something there. And I've had submarine officers come to me and tell me that. So more to follow for you, everybody. Now, so I've talked about the fact that I think the safety aspect's important for aviation. And the science is important just because it's interesting. But also there's the public policy piece. And if we're being visited and we're not acknowledging it, then it's impossible to develop appropriate public policy for it. And so now I've also joined the Seoul Foundation with Peter Skafish and Gary Nolan and to do that. And we attended their inaugural symposium a few weeks ago, which was just wonderful. But I think this is also an important and lacking area, and that's why I've stepped up and joined their advisory board. And this is where I want to help with my government expertise. I was joking the other day. I said to somebody, I know how Washington works, which is not really an accurate statement because there's too many examples of how Washington doesn't work. Right now is a good case in point. But that's what we're trying to do is really, and to summarize it, we need legislation like was proposed with the Schumer Amendment. It didn't go all the way. It was partially stripped, but that's, you know, we still have made progress. We'll keep pressing. But we also, we need the White House to act. The White House has to take ownership and develop policy, and both are lacking right now. Congress has done a lot more, and my knowledge of navigating those networks, I hope to bring to bear and help you, Peter, in your very important and very insightful mission. Now, I got back from the Galapagos Islands with my wife a couple weeks ago, and at the Seoul Foundation conference, it was interesting because we had a wide-ranging discussion about the phenomena with many different perspectives, like here today. I missed Joshua's talk, but I found the tail end of it very interesting. And I just think it's interesting that Jacques Vallée characterized it perfectly. He just said that really the only thing we can say about the phenomenon is just how diverse it is, and it seems to somehow present itself in a way that's very different and almost unique to each person or observer. And so there's that. But it just makes me remark after having been to the place of some of the most rich biological diversity in the planet, where Darwin postulated his theory of natural selection or after looking at the species here, you just have to, why would there not be a diversity of non-human intelligence elsewhere besides just this world and as we know it? So that's just something to think about. And if you ever have a chance to go diving in the Galapagos, you want to do it. So going forward, I'm going to steal a few quotes here. And this quote here is from a woman named Dr. Ea Whitley. And she is a space and aviation psychologist. She gave a really compelling presentation at the Seoul Foundation Symposium. And her area of psychology, she has looked at, this is what she observed. In aviation, anybody here a pilot? Of course. Okay. Good. And the 50s, maybe 60s, oh, even the 70s, I think, for pilots to report problems in the cockpit was taboo. Because, you know, your professional reputation to show weakness could be damaged and other reasons. And it took a lot of mishaps, a lot of aircraft falling out of the sky, sadly, to have that culture change where reporting is mandatory and everyone gets the importance of it and no one is graded or their performance isn't judged by reporting a problem. And that change took about 25 years, which is about a professional generation. And so that was her observation, and I thought that was brilliant. And I'm really I hope, and I see, especially when I look at the age of most of the people here, that that's happening with UAP. And this is the whole Galileo Project team and in front of, at Harvard. And you see a lot of young postdocs and in the room here too. So I applaud you all for showing interest. And I think keep doing that, keep promoting and being advocates for disclosure and research and policy development. And by doing that, you're going to make this mainstream. And I just wrote an article in The Messenger today, so check it out. But you're the future. And so thank you for that. And I'm here to help you. Okay, one more. So now I'm stealing another quote from Diana Pasulka, who will be talking today at the end. A great way to close up this fantastic day. And this is in her book, Encounters, I think? Yeah. And actually, it's in the cover sleeve of it. And this is the truth. It still mystifies me that more people are not acknowledging that. This is we're entering an era of new reality. And it's world-changing. And it's just, it is a new epic in our history. Because when you think about all that we might learn from the phenomena, it spans technology and science all the way to consciousness and everything associated with that, which is quite deep. And the breakthroughs that can be made and the opportunities are in every area that matters to us: energy, food security, transportation, biomedicine, you name it. I see a lot of opportunity. Now, there are challenges, of course. We could address that. But I guess Chris Mellon said it so well at the Soul Foundation. He said, national strategy based on ignorance has never been successful. So that's what we're talking about here. And that was a good presentation. So with that, I want to thank you all. It's great to be a part of this whole day with you. So happy to take your questions.
We're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back.
All right. Wonderful to see some hands in the air already. Let's start with Dr. Keith Taylor.
I have a first responder background, but what I'm concerned about also extends to our brave military soldiers and sailors and pilots. What will it take for the federal government to provide best practices regarding procedures, equipment, and policy to allow those who have a role in protecting the public to be able to handle NHI and UAV incidents instead of ignoring?
Yeah, that's good. Great question, Keith. Well, it's a couple answers to that. First off, legislation is always the most effective. Getting a law passed for that would targeting the agencies involved. That's why we went forward with the Schumer Amendment and had a House hearing. And so that we get in the Congress to act, then they could have the authority to direct the federal government and others. So that's one. But two, that's kind of top down. And similar, like I said, we need to get the White House interested. So we, like Soul Foundation, has to meet with the offices like the NSC and others to advocate for that. But secondly, bottom up also works. And so if you happen to have a relationship with anybody in a mid-level or senior position in the government that would be open to that, we should be talking to them. Because they still have some authority to change tactics, techniques, procedures, right? So, and that happens in the military. And so if you engage the right people and they see a need, that can be done too. So I think it takes all angles, top down, bottom up, and it can be done. Thanks.
Okay, we'll go to Bob.
Thank you. In 98, I was on the USS Hampton.
And, oh.
Yeah. Michael Mathis was the captain. Okay, so there were three teams that went out. Every one of them heard a USO. And I asked around, and it was every time they go out.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I hope you and others can help that data come out.
Thank you, Bob. For the audience, the USS Hampton is a Los Angeles-class nuclear-powered submarine. And the synchronicity between you and me right now are that I was on the USS Hampton in 2016 under the ice in the Arctic. How about that? So top that. No. No, great, great, great point, Bob. Thank you.
All right. I love that back and forth. That's wonderful. From Mary in the live stream chat, thanks so much for coming forward and lending your considerable credibility to this issue. Why have you come forward when so many others are staying quiet? And what can we do to get more military leaders to talk openly about the phenomenon?
That's a great question. Mary? Thank you, Mary. Interesting. You're right. Why not? And I wonder that too, because I'm astonished at the lack of intellectual curiosity. This is just amazing to me. And I think, though, the biggest reason, and I know every director of naval intelligence going back four or five positions, and as well as the directors of the agency that Grush worked with, the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency. These are all leaders I know, retired three-star admirals, et cetera. And I think some of them are bound by NDAs, of course. And I was never read in to a UFO SAP, basically. So I'm not bound by that. I was read into others, and I don't talk about that stuff. But there's a real concern about that, not wanting to get thrown in jail and that, or potentially reveal national security capabilities that could be disadvantaged to us and give our adversaries capabilities. But I'm not sure why more have not joined me, and that's why I am hopefully encouraging more to do that. So there's a little bit of a, I'm not sure why, but also I do know that some are bound by what they've signed up to. Thank you.
Great, thanks. I'll take one more for the live stream, and then we'll move to folks toward the middle and back of the room. This is from James Falk. Why would it be important and beneficial for the U.S. to lead the international effort at disclosure? In other words, what could we lose if another competitor nation goes first?
That's a good question. I don't know if we would lose. James?
James.
Yeah, it's a great question. I don't think we lose by not going first. But I actually addressed this at the Seoul Foundation Symposium, and I'm not going to get into it. I didn't want to get into a debate. I volunteered that America has shown leadership in many arenas and still does, and because we're well equipped to do it, and therefore we should, I think. And of course, one of the other speakers sort of countered me and said, "Well, we're not doing it with UNCLOS and this and that and the other," which is true. We're not. We can do better. But the fact remains, we are a leader in so many areas, far and above any other superpower. And in this area, our capabilities, obviously, we're learning, we know a lot. So I think it's just, we are absolutely the right choice to do it. And I do want to be a part of that international effort.
Thanks so much. Appreciate it. All right. We'll go to Zach next.
All right. Hi. Thank you that was enlightening, and thank you for being here. Are you able to offer any insight as to regarding the events of the GoFast incident, the data being fed to command, the email going out on your internal network, and then I believe you said it was the following day that then that email was gone, and then it was once that at some point, who else would have been privy? I assume various intelligence networks, possibly within the Pentagon. Can you offer any insight, if you're able, as to where the command to then pull that info away from those of you, in high levels of command, where that might have come from? And had you ever encountered anything like that before?
Great question, Zach. Thank you. So no, I never have before that or ever since encountered something like that. Now, let me qualify that. I have been at sea and involved in operations where on an unclassified communications channel, radio, email, someone inadvertently divulged classified information. And there's a process, I'm sure Alex knows this, that you follow. You immediately sort of just cease the communications, and I believe intelligence professionals go and do a sort of like a forensic analysis to see how far it got to understand it, and they assess the damage, if any. So there's like a process that I've seen out there in operations before, But this was a whole nother level, different. And I didn't know, I don't know where it went. Now, I can speculate because I know the government and I know the intelligence community well. And likely, and we're seeing this, you know, Lou Elizondo would be the best person to answer this, or Chris Mellon. But it was probably DIA, the Defense Intelligence Agency, had the ownership of that program. And I don't know how they found out, because they're not usually monitoring Navy comms, but operational comms, at that matter. But somehow that did. And it was probably the intelligence officer at the squadron, or no, at Fleet Forces. And he probably realized it and sent it to his DIA counterpart, and they said cease and desist. And nobody said anything afterwards. That's what I surmise. And I don't think that's a hard conclusion to draw if you read up on this stuff and recent books and things like that. Yeah, Zach?
Thanks very much. I see, Dan Zetterstrom. Dan's got a question.
Hey, Tim, thank you for everything you just presented. It's great to know that someone's looking at the oceans. This week, a lot of us were disappointed that the NDAA Schumer Act, the UAP Disclosure Act of 2023, didn't pass. And obviously, we're going to have to take a run at it next year. I wondered what, in your opinion, would be the most advantageous thing to get added to the bill next year to ensure UAP transparency?
Thanks. Tom, is it? Dan, sorry. Thanks, Dan. Yeah, I thought the bill as proposed before it got stripped was had everything needed with the UAP records review panel, et cetera. That I thought was, and it by name said the things that we would look at and address with this controlled disclosure. And I know at the Sol Foundation Symposium, little bit of a leak with Carl Nell's slide on a campaign plan, but that was the best presentation of how to go forward that I think anybody could come up with. That'd be my answer. We're going to reattack. That's what we're going to do. It's going to take time. This is not the first time legislation hasn't gotten over the goal line so fully. We got like a field goal instead of the touchdown. And next year, let's go for the touchdown.
Right. There we go.
Hi, I feel a little bit like Tracy Flick because I'm really aggressively putting my hand up. But you were talking about how this issue needs to affect and will affect public policy. And I'm wondering about looking at how it needs to affect foreign policy. I lived in Abu Dhabi for a couple of years and worked very closely with the embassy there, the US embassy there. And I keep in touch with people still, not necessarily in the embassy, but who are working in the area. And I know that China is increasingly becoming involved there, both in terms of soft power and potentially maybe building a base there. We also know that China's building islands and doing a lot of drilling inland. And I wonder if you can speak to any of those and if they do correlate to the issue we're talking about, or if I'm just making connections that are dubious.
What's your name?
My name's Laura.
Laura. Okay, Laura, thanks for your question. That's a lot to chew on, but because there, it's actually really unfortunate. Here we are getting visited by who knows who, that with intelligence and capability beyond what we can understand right now. And one would wish, and Chris Mellon wrote this really beautifully in an article in his presentation at Seoul about maybe this will be our Sputnik moment. Maybe this will bring us all together. And initially, Sputnik was a national security concern, and we got we got someone on the moon, and the space program took off. And then now we have international collaboration in space, and it's moved from national security to international collaboration. Great. One would hope that happens with this. And we know other nations are having are involved with programs and disclosure efforts, et cetera. The trouble is we can't be myopic and Pollyanna with China. You cited just the tip of the iceberg on so much of their unlawful, harmful activity. And it would be nice, but we have to sort of trust but verify. Hope for the best, but prepare for the worst. And they're showing no signs of easing on their aggressive foreign policy. So I'd say we have to really be pragmatic about that, but still seek cooperative solutions when we can. Thanks, Laura.
Yeah, thanks, Laura. We've got a question from Travis on the live stream. As much as you can say, are you aware of any patterns whatsoever with USO sightings and related data that you have access to that you can speak of?
Travis, that's a great question. No is the answer. But that would be the purpose of the survey I proposed, is let's just understand what's out there. And if there are patterns, and like the ARRO is doing in the DOD, as much as people want them to do more, at least they're doing a good job at least categorizing what's going on. That's important. That's really a foundational work. And that'd be my goal for USOs, is to do something similar with all the data. And in fact, the reason I was going out and proposing this study is I had called ARRO, and they said, we don't have enough funding. We're not going to look at anything underwater. But now they have more funding, and they actually are. And Keith, that submarine report, I vectored to them, and they're investigating it. So we'll find out about, and same with you, Bob, if that data exists, and it exists, then we're going to see how open they really are. And by the way, this is worth mentioning. So you have the ARRO doing what they're doing. I'm sure you're the Domain Anomaly Resolution Office in the DOD, I assume most of you know what that is. It's the DOD's UFO office. The thing about that is, again, they're releasing some things, but they only can release what their bosses tell them they can release. And who are they? Well, the Secretary of Defense, Director of National Intelligence, and the White House, National Security Council. And it's obvious to me they're directing them to be tight with what they say. And they are not supporting a policy disclosure. Now that's it. That's a fact, and that's why we need to engage those offices. And there were some signs that they might be open to it with the Schumer legislation, because Schumer's a Democrat, and obviously Schumer would not have gone forward if there wasn't somebody in the White House who advocated for it. So there was some willingness, and they realized the White House can't go out and get ahead of its skis, if you will. Meaning. Certain policymakers until legislation's passed and the president says it's okay. And I've been involved in things like this. So, yeah, we just have to see where that goes. Sorry, long answer there, but.
Oh, a similar question, though. Is the U.S. Navy sharing data on anomalous activity with Five Eyes intelligence partners and other allies globally? That's from Pete of Paranormal Blip.
Thank you, Pete. Is the Navy sharing data on UAP with Five Eyes allies, basically? And I don't know, again, because they're not really sharing what they do know and publicly. And I'm out of the Navy now, and I only shared you the one experience I had, so I don't know. But we should be looking into that.
Okay, thanks. Any other questions? All right, here we go.
Hello, good morning. Thank you very much for your presentation. When you were speaking about the survey, Do you have any knowledge of the seafloor survey 2030? I don't know if is it a private endeavor, or is it government and private, or would that contribute to this effort? Could that contribute to this effort?
Yes, what's your name?
Pituka.
Pituka?
Yes.
Great question. So this is worth talking about. There is a larger international effort called Seabed 2030 to map the ocean floor. I forgot the statistics, to be honest with you. But ultimately, we have not mapped even 50% of the Earth's ocean floor to modern standards with a multi-beam sonar. And we know the surface of Mars and the Moon to a higher resolution than we do the world's oceans. If you talk about the ocean volume, we haven't even monitored 10% of it, not even that. So we don't know a thing, really, about 90% of the volume of the ocean, which is crazy. And I was a big advocate at NOAA for this. I actually launched a national program to map, explore, and characterize the ocean, and it got passed. It's still being implemented by the White House and the agencies under it, NASA, NOAA, the Navy, and that was the goal. At the time, we hadn't even mapped 40% of the U.S. EEZ, Exclusive Economic Zone. Now we've surpassed that. So yeah, Seabed 2030 is the international part of the national effort I led. And yes, absolutely right. We want to characterize the seafloor like we've done other planets and determine if we can learn something about what these phenomena are doing. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Patuka. This is from Lori in the chat. It seems after the Rendlesham Forest UFO that the heat from the craft brought about more infrared detection of aerial UFOs. Is there any way to test heat anomalies produced by underwater UAP?
Is there any way to test heat anomalies
produced by underwater UAP?
Well, there are. There's a rather extensive environmental observation network in the ocean of buoys. They're called Argo buoys, and they measure temperature, as well as drones. There's my old Navy command had a fleet of 120 of these drones, underwater drones, that would go up and down in the ocean water column and measure temperature, which is really important for the Navy because knowing the thermal structure of the ocean allows you to predict sound propagation, which is really valuable for Navy submarines, as you know. So, there's a giant network out there, including government and academia, that I'm very involved with right now, still in my day job. And so it can be done.
Great. I've got one more kind of fun question, and this is from James in the chat. Has Tim ever heard any reports of unidentified submerged objects or related phenomena interacting with dolphins, whales, or other cetaceans?
Right, marine mammals, a beautiful life in the ocean area. That I don't know because we don't even know enough about USOs. So to even say, do we understand what they're doing in interacting with other life? We just don't know enough. But that's a great question. You have to, and I think, I didn't address this, but I could. I did the government nuts and bolts part. I know there's this other part that Joshua addressed and we will talk about too. And that's interesting. So we have consciousness. You know those animals are very highly developed. They have consciousness. And with that component of the phenomena that's well-written, like in Skinwalkers of the Pentagon, et cetera, you got to wonder how they interact with other life. And I'll just leave it at that.
All right. Thank you so much, Tim. Really appreciate it. It's a 10 to 1.